Blog Talk Radio.
Do you want Detroit sports talk done right?
Yeah!
If you want it, you got it. It's Detroit sports talk with attitude. It's the Knee Jerks with Eno and Big Al.
Listen, I like Angelot.
That's driven in the air toward left field, way back. Brandon Inge puts the charge into another one. It's gone!
I like him a lot.
Culpepper. Jordan drops it as he throws. Deep downfield, Calvin Johnson. And he's going all the way. Touchdown, Lions.
Brings it in. And stops. The reverse slam by Tayshaun Prince.
It's time to put on the knee brace and get ready for a workout. It's two guys who know Detroit sports. Here's Greg Eno and Al Beaton.
It's 7 p.m., October 24th, 2011. You're listening to the Knee Jerks, Detroit Sports Talk with Eno and Big Al on the Sports Geeks Radio Network, sportsgeeksradio.com. I'm Al Beaton, a.k.a. Big Al of the Wayne Fonts Experience, waynefonts.com, and bless you boys, blessyouboys.com. Every Monday night, I get together with the man I call the voice of reason, Mr. Old School, Mr. Excitement, and several other names that are too, well, I can't say in front of sensitive eyes or ears. That would be Mr. Greg Eno of GregEno.com. Greg, how you doing tonight?
I've been thrown out of better places than this, Al.
Of course.
I'm doing fine. I am Greg Eno from GregEno.com. That's where you can read me every day of the week. You can also follow me on Twitter. Twitter.com/Greg Eno and follow the Knee Jerks on Twitter at theKneeJerks.info and follow us on our Facebook fan page, Facebook.com/TheKneeJerks. Programming note, next week, the 31st of October, is, of course, Halloween, but that's not going to stop the ghosts and goblins aren't going to stop Big Al from doing the show next week, but I will not be there. I will be replaced by guest co-host Adam Biggers, friend of the Knee Jerks and Spartans blogger, but Adam can certainly talk about a lot of different sports. So he'll be co-hosting the show next Monday night with guest Lee Panis of Detroit Tiger Tales, one of the best Tiger blogs on the net, and another Tiger guest as well as Al and Adam interview Lee and the other guests about the off-season, a review of the Tigers' 2011 season and also a look ahead to the off-season and what the team needs to do to improve to take that next step toward the elusive World Series championship. So that's going to be next week. And then 2 weeks from tonight, Al, we're working on our friend Jamie Samuelson from WCSX. That's November the 7th, so we hope to have Jamie here at that point. We have a, what we do, Al, here, when we want to talk Red Wings, we go to our Red Wings insider, Matt Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
We want to talk Pistons, we go to our friend from the Detroit News, Vinny Goodwill. And when we want to talk Lions or the NFL, where do we go? But, of course, to our Lions insider, Mike Schotte. And Mike is our guest tonight. But before we get into Mike and a special announcement about Mike, by the way, let's play the first round of Whose Birthday Is It Today?
And we will do that in 3, 2, 1.
Music, of course, signifies whose birthday is it. A weekly game we play here, a very simple game. I give Al a clue or two of the identity of a sports figure whose birthday it is today. That person could be alive or dead. Been on a roll with alive people here, so I'm going to continue it with another alive person. Happy to announce that this person is alive. He is 85 years old today. He was born on this date in 1926. In Marshall, Texas, he went to school at Louisiana State University, where he starred in football and was drafted in the first round of the 1948 draft by the old Baltimore Colts. This isn't the NFL Baltimore Colts. This is the AAFC, the All-American Football Conference Baltimore Colts. It only lasted for a couple of years. He was drafted by them in 1948. And in the first round, which started his 7-time Pro Bowl career. So that's the first quote.
God, about the only person I can think of, it comes off the top of my head from the All-American Football Conference is one Otto Graham, but that's just off the top of my head.
That's a great guess, really. It's not Otto Graham, but that's a great guess. You're right. That's this person is a contemporary of Otto Graham for sure, and that's a great guess, but it's not Otto Graham. So we move on to clue number two after we get done with.
I feel so good after such a good guess. Oh my God! You know, better to
it was
say
a very
pass.
Good guess. that was a Graham, really, truly. I mean, I would lay bet that Otto Graham was probably born also in 1926. That's how good of a guess that is. Anyway, our guest tonight, as I alluded to earlier, is one Michael Schotte of a number of places. Of course, not the least of which is Sports Geeks Radio's own Michael Schotte. He hosts the Average Joe Sports Show here on the Sports Geeks Radio Network, sportsgeeksradio.com. He's also anointed by me, Detroit Lions insider here in the Knee-Jerks, and also, of course, writes for Bleacher Report. But I want to really congratulate Mike, because he was some really great news came out last week about Mike. He was honored by the National Pro Football Writers of America, Al. He took second place in the columns category in the Dick Connor Writing Awards for his Bleacher Report piece last year after that first game loss the Lions had in Chicago. And the title of the piece was Detroit Lions Lost to Chicago Bears, Calvin Johnson's Fault, Not Referees. And as you can imagine, it was not the most popular piece in Detroit. It was well written enough to win second place in the columns category of the Dick Connor Writing Awards. I'm sure there were no Detroit people on that voting ensemble. But Mike Schotte, congratulations, good job, my friend.
Yeah, thank you. I still hold that same opinion that as screwed as the Lions might have been, as just silly and weird as that rule is written. I still feel like Calvin Johnson should have known the rule and come up with that football. And let me tell you, that's not a popular opinion around Detroit.
No, it's not. But Mike Schotte will go to his grave saying that. I know he will, because he took a very steadfast – I remember that. He took a very steadfast stance on that and hasn't wavered, and good for him. You know, that's to be commended. But Mike is here to talk 2011 Lions, not 2010 Lions. Lots to talk about, Mike. I was telling Al before the show that it's certainly more interesting being 5-2 than being 2-5, but it's a tenuous 5-2. It seems like right now, of course, the Lions won their first five games and have dropped the last two. We're going to get into a lot of stuff here with Michael. We got about 40 minutes to do so. Let's get right into it. First, the question I want to ask you, Mike, is about Matthew Stafford, a quarterback. First of all, before I ask the question, do you have any late information about Matthew Stafford's condition?
Well, I just know what came out in the press conference today. Jim Schwartz is very guarded with injury information, but what came out today is that he's in a walking boot for an ankle sprain. He wouldn't discuss the severity of the ankle sprain if it's one of those dreaded high ankle sprains. He wouldn't go into any of that, but he basically said he's day-to-day, and if there was anything worse than a routine ankle sprain, he probably wouldn't be day-to-day. Now, I wrote quickly afterwards that, you know, this is Jim Schwartz. That could very easily mean he's going on IR tomorrow with a concussion. But as much as Jim Schwartz has said, which we know might have no basis in reality whatsoever, as much as he's said, he should be ready to go this week, and obviously Lion fans hope that is the case.
And also about Matthew Stafford, Mike, is, you know, forget the injury. It seemed like the last couple of games, he hasn't had that Matthew Stafford swagger that he had in the first five games. I know he's been under a lot of pressure in the last two games by some weak pass protection, but he just seems like a different guy out there. I look at the tight shots that they take of him out with the television cameras. He just doesn't look like the same guy. I mean, what's your opinion about Stafford's demeanor?
Yeah, you guys have been around me long enough, and some of your listeners might remember back to when I watched Matthew Stafford coming out of college and had some pretty negative opinions about him. I always said that bar none, he's a phenomenal athlete. He's a guy who's going to win tons of football games in the NFL. But I always said that he has some maddening stretches of poor decision-making, and that I don't think he had the crazy pinpoint accuracy that some people were saying. And right now, we're going through one of those stretches. I've turned 180 on Matthew Stafford. I'm glad they drafted him. I'm so glad he's a Detroit Lion. I think he's one of the key cogs to this team being successful in the future, and I think he has that in him. But right now we're going through one of those stretches where, you know, you said he's lost his swagger. I feel like he still has the confidence, but now it's a confidence that's hurting him rather than confidence that's helping him. He's still throwing the ball as if he's on target, but he hasn't done anything to make sure he's actually on target. His feet aren't sent. He's making some really poor decisions in the pocket. And I truly do believe these are all correctable issues, and it's just kind of a schneid that he's on right now. But bar none, I almost want to see him be hurt for a week so he can sit on the bench and watch Sean Hill take his team to a victory. Because right now, I don't think Matt Stafford's the reason that the Lions have lost the last two games, but I don't think he's done anything to put them in a position to win either.
Right. Yeah, that's probably a good assessment of the situation. I even noticed it in the Bears game on Monday night a couple weeks ago where he missed, I thought, some balls that normally he wouldn't miss, some open receivers. And you're right, the pattern has kind of continued against San Francisco and Atlanta where he's had guys open, he's had guys there, and even the catches that have been made, I noticed Calvin had a reach behind him a couple of times. You know, just hasn't been that, you know, in stride pinpoint guy that we've seen earlier in the season. And like you said, maybe it's just a matter of a slump. But how much longer, though, can these things go on, Michael? I mean, you've coached football before. How much longer can these kinds of funks go on before the confidence does take a hit?
I don't think Matthew Stafford is the kind of guy whose confidence will ever take a hit, and that's both a good and a bad thing. I mean, we saw long stretches from this from guys like Brett Favre where he wasn't playing well at all, but he's still slinging the ball all over the field. I think as a coaching staff, you need to point those things out to him and get him to correct it before it's, I don't want to say too late because that sounds too foreboding, but until more damage is done, what he's doing is fine in terms of confidence, where he's taking his shots, when he's taking his shots, but the exact same throw, the exact same decision being made can have two different effects depending on how well you throw that ball. And if you just sling the ball out there, you're right, there's a lot of passes behind receivers like Calvin Johnson. And what happens then is it's not just that some of the passes are bad. It's when you're throwing bad passes, even your good passes catch your receivers off guard. You lose your rhythm. You lose the tempo of the offense. And passes that would have been caught in a rhythm offense all of a sudden are out of rhythm and are going to get dropped. We saw a bad drop by Nate Burleson last week. That probably changed the game. We saw a bad drop the week before from Brandon Pettigrew. Now, Pettigrew has had a propensity for drops in the past, so that doesn't surprise us. But Nate Burleson, when this guy is dropping a ball, you can't blame that on Nate Burleson because Nate Burleson has never had a drops stigma in the past. You have to say there's something weird with their chemistry, and when your quarterback is misfiring so often, even the most catchable balls becomes hard because you're all of a sudden fighting it in your body because you're trying to do too much. And so really what it has to be is I wish Jim Schwartz would have done a little bit more in his press conference today to get the pressure off the rest of the offense, but I was very glad that at least he said something along the lines of there's been some errant passes. You know, he didn't put the blame on Matthew Stafford. I don't think you call a guy out publicly, but you have to, give credit where credit is due. And you also have to give blame when blame is due because you can't all of a sudden let the fans, dog the offensive line and dog Brandon Pettigrew and dog Nate Burleson when those guys don't deserve it. You have to put some of the blame on Matthew Stafford, and Matthew Stafford has to take some of that blame on himself and say, you know what, I left some balls out there. That's not going to happen in the future.
Well, you know, that kind of reminds me of what Mike Babcock does, the coach of the Red Wings. He won't call out the goalie, for example, but he'll say things like the puck went in the net. You know, things like that that would just kind of coach speak or Babcock speak for we had bad goaltending tonight or something of that nature. And not that that's ever really a big revelation because, as was witnessed Saturday night in Washington, Ty Conklin was awful. And so, you know, you can draw your own conclusions. But so what you're saying with Schwartz saying that there were some errant passes is kind of reminds me of how Coach Babcock talks about goaltending and other aspects of his team's game. We're talking with Mike Schottie, our Lions insider here from the Sports Geeks Radio Network's Average Joe Sports Show, and of course Bleacher Report. We're talking Lions here on the Knee Jerks. I'm Greg Eno from GregEno.com, and Big Al Beaton from the Wayne Fonts Experience, WayneFonts.com. Mike, the 5-0 start was obviously dotted with a couple of incredible come-from-behind victories. So there was always, I think, maybe a little distrust about that, about the 5-0 start. But in these last two games, is this because the pass protection has become all of a sudden so sieve-like, like a sieve, versus the first four or five games? Are other NFL teams now starting to figure this Lions offense out? Or is it a case of there's no job at best? Or is it a case of this is just a mini slump? I mean, what's going on? Why does the team look so much different offensively, Mike, in the last two games than they did in the first five?
Well, again, I just want to reiterate, I don't want to put all of the blame on Matthew Stafford, but I do think he carries a larger portion of the blame. And I think that's natural. Again, I don't want to dog him too much, but I think it's natural that you draft a guy first overall, you pay him $70 million, you expect him to elevate the level of play from those guys around him. I think taking away Matthew Stafford, taking him out of the equation, you have to look at the offensive line first. They haven't played well really all season long. They had a stretch where they didn't give up a sack. I think that was a misleading stat. They were still giving up lots of pressures. But when you look at Stafford the last two games, really the last four, his internal clock has not been right. And you really saw it last week against San Francisco that he was rushing passes and not feeling the rush like he should. And this week it was even worse. And maybe that started a little bit with Chicago, who obviously have a very good pass rush, both interior and on the edge. But whatever it is, Matthew Stafford needs to feel that rush and give his O-line some help. One of the biggest, one of the most maddening things about being a guy who covers the Lions is fans wanting something to be there that isn't there. And maybe this happens with all teams, but I'm sick of hearing fans say, well, the offensive line is a problem. Guess what? It's 2011. The offensive line is a problem. It's going to be a problem for the next eight weeks. That's not going to change. Matthew Stafford has the ability, the power to change things of his play that helps bail out the offensive line. There's no job at best right now. Well, guess what? That's the case. We don't have Mikel Ashore either. That's not going to change this season, so there's got to be things that happen. And I think the main cog here has to be Matthew Stafford, because the offense isn't going to change drastically without Mikel Ashore and without job at best. We still have pieces there in guys like Kylan Williams, Maurice Morris, and even Stephen Logan that can pick up that slack. I think the value of a replacement player isn't nearly as big as people want to assume it is, especially in this offense. You can do some things to change that. But Matthew Stafford hasn't changed. And I think he needs to speed up his internal clock a little bit, get a little more comfortable in the pocket, get that thing back on track. And from there, I think the biggest thing needs to be hitting his passes, because if he's rushing his passes or not feeling the rush, that's going to be more sacks, and that's going to be more incompletions. And I had a long talk today with a couple of people about play calling, and when it comes down to it, it doesn't matter if you're running on first or second down or passing on first or second down, you need to execute those plays. And if you're executing passes, that opens up the run game. If you're executing runs, it opens up the play action pass. And I think a lot of that, again, falls on the players as a whole, but I think it mostly falls upon Matthew Stafford.
We're talking with Mike Schotte of SportsGeeksRadio.com's Average Joe Sports Show, and, of course, Bleacher Report, listening to the Knee Jerks. I'm Greg Eno from GregEno.com, and Big Al Beaton from the Wayne Fonts Experience, WayneFonts.com. And let's bring Big Al in. What you got from Mike Schotte?
Well, think of it this way with the Lions. Yes, they are 5-2, but two of the wins that they had were of the I hate to put it as once in a generation, as they did it twice in a, no, they did it two times in within 2 weeks of each other. But still, is this a 5-2 really a 5-2 team, or is this a team that is closer to maybe being, say, 3-4 or 2-5 that got lucky? What's your take on the actual talent level of the team?
Yeah, I don't believe in luck, and I don't believe that you're anything different than what your record says you are. They've won some tough games, and I think you have to give them credit for having the character to win those tough games. You don't want to take those away from them, because they played phenomenal in those second halves, and that's something we haven't seen out of the Lions team in a long time. So I'm not taking that away from them. I think they're a 5-2 team. But if you're projecting, you know, people projected them right around 7 wins, 8 wins coming into the season. After they went to 5-0, people really felt that maybe they could be a 10-11-win team. I never believed that. I think this is a team that is very good, but struggles to be great because they beat themselves a whole lot. And I think the talent level, as much as we're seeing an improvement of talent from years past, as we kind of scrape off the ashes from the Matt Millen era, we're still not there yet. You look at a team like the Packers, who can have a ton of players go on IR now 2 years in a row and still feel the 6-0 team. You look at a team, again, the Green Bay Packers, that have a quarterback like Aaron Rodgers, who's playing as well as anyone right now. Everyone else can be hurt on their offense. As long as they have him, he puts them in a chance to win games. Right now, the Lions' best player, the only player who exceeds what the defense can put out there, is Calvin Johnson. And there's a lot that has to go right for Calvin Johnson to get the ball and get into the end zone. You need to have protection. You need to have a good throw. You need to be able to drag coverage off of him with other receivers. A lot needs to go right for Calvin Johnson to take over a game. Other teams don't have that. A guy like Adrian Peterson can take over a game by himself. A guy like Aaron Rodgers can take over a game by himself. This is still a very good Lions team, but I still think they lack the supporting pieces. They need some help along the line. They need a little more help in the defensive backfield. And they need probably a little more help in the linebacking core as well, as good as they've been. Again, it's weird to look at because they're so much better than they were in years past, but you still see that they're not an elite NFL team. And I think that's a struggle for Lions fans to balance those two thoughts.
Let's talk in a little more esoteric terms about this start, because you know, one of the things that Al and I talked about on the program a couple of weeks ago, actually even earlier than that, was how the Lions would handle success, and of course success in Detroit being defined as getting off to the start that they got off to. I mean, that's heady stuff for us. We're not used to that. The players aren't either. We saw what happened in 2007, and granted, that was a much less talented team than they have now. And they got off to that 6-2 start, and were not able to sustain it. I remember Michael Strahan very candidly saying after the Giants beat them that that was the worst 6-3 team I've ever seen. So, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at here, Mike, is you've got players like Corey Williams, who was quoted yesterday as saying that, you know, we just don't seem to be the same team as we were. We got to get that back. We got to get, maybe guys are getting too comfortable. It's too early for that. You know, that kind of stuff, I guess this is kind of what I was worried about, was when a team that's not used to tasting success for any sustainable period of time gets off to that kind of a start, and then when things go a little bit off kilter, like a two-game losing streak in the NFL is not anything to jump off the bridge about, but with a team like the Lions, do you get the feeling that maybe they're still a little bit emotionally fragile?
Yeah, I think it's easy to say that last year we didn't think they could win, that they needed to learn how to win, and I think that it's just as valid a notion that they need to know how to handle success now that they've had it. They were 5-0. They obviously did not handle success very well. They looked woefully unprepared to face the San Francisco 49ers, and they didn't really look like they had a great game plan and pace this last week as well. I think they need to learn how to handle success as well as they've handled adversity. And, when they were the plucky underdog, they felt like they could feel that and played up to that. And then when they were the favorite team, they played down to their opponents a little bit, not to take anything away from their last two opponents, who were both good teams. But I do think they do look comfortable, and I think now going to Denver, playing a very hyped Denver Broncos team with Tim Tebow under center, I think that'll be good for them, because maybe they'll stop reading their press clippings a little bit.
Right.
And one of the weirdest things is thinking that the Lions might be more successful on the road than at home. But
right.
I think one of the biggest things, too, is, I've said this with Stafford, and I'll now throw this on the defense as well. But as well as they've played, you need to play to win. you can't just believe your own hype and play as good as you think you can play. You need to play better than that. And I think guys like Williams and Sue, and to a lesser extent, maybe Chris Houston and Louis Delmas in that same package, they've played well, and they've done what they, you know, should do, but they haven't played to win. We've seen some pretty mind-numbing stupidity from Sue and Williams in the past couple of games, and we've seen some blown coverage in the secondary, and that's just not acceptable. That's one of those things that they weren't doing in weeks 1 through 3, at least for the entire game. They were able to overcome it in week 4 and 5, and then last week it just snowballed. And when you are giving up first downs on penalties, and when you're on offense missing first downs because of penalties, because you put yourself in first and long, second and long, those are mistakes that you can make up for, but if you're doing them continually from week to week, it becomes a pattern, and you have to pull yourself out of that tailspin. So again, I have no problem agreeing with you that now that they've learned how to deal with adversity, they need to also learn how to deal with success.
Let's bring Big Al back into the discussion. We're talking with Mike Schotte from SportsGeeksRadio.com's Average Joe Sports Show and also from Bleacher Report on the Knee Jerks here. Let's bring Big Al in. What you got from Mike Schotte?
Yeah, Mike, yeah, I think you might have there's something to what you're saying about the reading their press clipping, so to speak. It seems over the last few weeks, especially since after the big win on Monday night against Chicago, that there's just this feeling with the Lions team that they're there's this maybe an over-the-top swagger with this team. You know, a lot of this came out from the complaining that we got from the Atlanta Falcons after the game yesterday about trash talking and things like that. But it really comes kind of off-putting coming from a Lions team that really, when you think about it, is still a long way from being elite. Yeah, they won 9 straight games over 2 years, but don't you think that your confidence is one thing, but arrogance is another, and maybe the Lions over the last few weeks have stepped over that line?
Yeah, it's become unsavory to a point, and I think you have to balance our feelings about it to the fact that the media has latched onto this, and I think other teams have latched onto this as well. It's easy for the Atlanta Falcons to say following the game, they were trash-talking, because you don't have to back that up. You don't have to provide audio, and the media will just glom onto that. Whereas, Cliff Avril said right after the game, that's crap, we never did that, that's not us. And Ndamukong Suh and both he and Coach Schwartz rebutted it again today. So whether or not the Atlanta Falcons stuff actually happened, it seems like something that shouldn't even be a storyline. Like, if you look at Coach Schwartz and especially Martin Mayhew, the aura they have about them, so insulated, so guarded, and as emotional as Schwartz can get, so insulated from the spotlight, it's crazy that he now has a team that's known for bravado, because that's not who their coach is. Again, as emotional as he has been. And I do think that a little bit has been, you said reading your own press clippings. I think a lot of it has just become magnified because now it's a storyline. And anytime we see anything from the Lions about it, we'll see that amplified in the media as a whole. But I do agree with you that it's become unsavory, that I liked the Lions, the plucky underdog, and I liked them as the team that just won. Mm-hmm. And now they're the team that, winning or losing, seems to be making storylines with their, quote-unquote, swagger. And teams like that have just never performed well for long stretches in the NFL because a lot of that swagger turns into false bravado, and you never like to see teams that have that.
Hey, and just to follow up on that, obviously the Jim Schwartz, Jim Harbaugh kerfuffle from 2 weeks ago, obviously I think both coaches were in the wrong, but do you think what we've seen from this team over the past 2 weeks, is it coming from Schwartz's attitude itself, or is it a combination of Schwartz and maybe guys like Ndamukong Suh?
Well, again, what's crazy is that, Schwartz, for all of his emotionalism, was never really known as that guy until the Harbaugh thing happened. And Ndamukong Suh, if you look back to him in Nebraska, was known as such a clean-cut guy that there's something coming from this. And you almost have to kind of look for the bad egg in the dozen. And, if I had to start looking, I would probably immediately go to Corey Williams because he's known for this sort of thing. But there's something about this team, and I almost feel like you need to nip it in the bud before it becomes a bigger deal. But again, if this were a 7-0 team, we wouldn't be talking about this.
Right.
You know, the Schwartz-Harbaugh thing happened after a loss. The Dominguez-Sue thing happened after a loss. And had those been wins, I don't know if they'd be bigger storylines, because we'd be still be talking about the undefeated Packers and Lions possibly meeting on Thanksgiving. But because of the losses, I think it's going to get a little more publicity, and because it's become kind of a storyline with, you know, Dirty Sue and, you know, Schwartz has this team out of control, it's become a storyline, it's become amplified. But I really hate to pin it on Schwartz just because I've met the guy a few times, and that's not him. What the media shows of Jim Schwartz is not Jim Schwartz, and so I really don't think that the team is glodding onto his, you know, his over-the-top persona, because I don't think he has one.
We're talking with Mike Schotte of the SportsGeeksRadio.com's Average Joe Sports Show, and also, of course, from Bleacher Report. You're listening to The Knee Jerks. I'm Greg Eno from GregEno.com, and you just heard Big Al Beaton from the Wayne Fonts Experience, WaynePonce.com. Let's get back to some more X's and O's, Mike, maybe a little more schematic things defensively. A troubling thing to me, and I know I'm not alone here, is the amount of long runs that the Lions have been giving up. They've been gashed in the last 3 weeks on their home field by Matt Forte a little bit, Frank Gore a little bit, and Michael Turner a little bit. And they've come at inopportune times, not that there's ever an opportune time to give up a big run, but they've come at times where they've really kind of taken the air out of the balloon at Ford Field. And they've, of course, you know, on top of that, they've been big plays just in the course of the football game. For supposedly as talented as this defensive line is, and you mentioned the linebackers maybe having to step up, what are you seeing from your coaches, when you put your coaches' glasses on, what are you seeing, Mike, out there on the field that is maybe symptomatic of why this team is giving up at an alarming rate 30, 40, 50-yard runs?
Yeah, it's partially a schematic thing. If I hear one of the Fox announcers say the word wide nine again without explaining what they're talking about, I might explode. And just as an aside, how absolutely stupid was it this past Sunday that they actually had something put together to explain the wide nine defense with Brian Billick, and they made it a joke, fast-forwarding through all of it. That would have been awesome to see. Back to the Lions, because of the wide nine, because Corey Williams plays, you know, lines up somewhere in no-buy, they're going to get gashed eventually. And what happens is that the offensive line will let Ndamukong Suh into the backfield. You wham him with a blocker, whether that's a wide fullback or an H-back coming from the other side, as some teams have done, or you just pull a guard and bring him completely out of the play, run right behind him because of the formation, because of the misdirection. You've got Stephen Tulloch going the other way. You've got one guy to beat till daylight. And teams have been able to do that effectively. In weeks 1-3, I think Ndamukong Suh was playing the wham really, really well. I think he was feeling that. It's not feeling pressure. It's feeling I played as a defensive lineman, and when you come off the snap, you know when they're not blocking you. And as a pass rusher, if you have a pass rusher's mentality, you say, I'm not being blocked. They made a mistake. I'm going to go get the quarterback. But if you're playing smart, you say, why didn't they block me? And you turn, and there's the guy. You take that blocker on, you stuff him back into the hole, and you get the running back, too. And I think Ndamukong Suh for the past couple of weeks hasn't played smart. He's played as a pass rusher. He's gotten into the backfield. He's gotten decent penetration, but they're just running right behind him or blocking off of him. And, I mean, I'm going to take enough heat for calling out Stafford on this program. So let's call out Q2 too, because they're running right at him. And you shouldn't be able to do that. If you're such a talented lineman, you should be able to stop that. And now, again, it's partially a schematic thing, so you also need to call on Corey Williams and Nick Fairley to step up, and you need to call on Stephen Tulloch to step up, because schematically it's a weak point. But eventually, again, Ndamukong Suh has to beat that play. He has to play smart enough to beat that play. Also, I do think that in the last couple of weeks, if we look at the offensive or the defensive line breakdown numbers, I do feel like they've left Suh and Williams in a lot longer. There was a weird stretch last week where Suh sat out for a while and Fairley was in, but But other than that, it seems like the defensive line rotation we're used to seeing hasn't been nearly as heavy. And when it's happened, it hasn't been nearly as effective. We'll see Willie Young for long stretches at the end of the game, but we won't see him sprinkled in at the end of the half or in the third quarter. And I do think the defensive line is getting tired. And I think it's a false move by the coaches saying, hey, we've been having some trouble, let's leave our starters in, when what's gotten you here is the heavy rotation and keeping your starters fresh. So I do think they need to get back to that defensive line rotation. And also, as good as the linebackers have been this season, I think they do need a little help to rotate guys like Bobby Carpenter in and maybe even get Doug Hogan to the action a little bit. Not because he's better than the starters, but because if they're going to get run against, if they're going to get whammed against multiple times a game by good running backs, they're going to need that rotation. They're going to need to be fresh. And most importantly, they need to have some more confidence because they've been playing well and we're getting wins. And then I think they played well against the 49ers and Frank Gore and the offensive line of the 49ers, which is better than them. And now they're playing out of themselves, trying to get back on track. So I do feel, again, that a lot of things in the Denver game are not only going to come back to you know, help the Lions get a win because Denver's such a bad team, but I also think it might get them back on track defensively with a little more confidence because as long as they don't play outside of themselves, if they do what they can do and play their base defense to perfection like they can, I think they should have no problem taking down the Broncos.
Well, that's what's so ironic about this season, guys, when you think about it. You know, everybody was lauding the front four, sometimes the front seven, but certainly the front four, and everybody kind of gnashed their teeth and wringed their hands over the secondary. And when you look back at all the big plays the Lions have given up this season, they've almost predominantly been on the ground. They haven't really been giving up a lot of big plays through the air. Not a lot of long passes where a guy's wide open. You know, have they had some blown coverages on occasion? Sure, but the really big, just gut-wrenching plays they've been giving up have come on the ground, which I've always felt anyway is much more of a dagger than anything you do through the air, because anything can happen when you throw the ball up in the air. But when you can't stop the run and a guy gets, blows through you, like we saw on Monday night when Jabba Best ran 88 yards against the Bears without being touched, and you could see how that deflate emotionally brought the Bears down, and you could see the body language on the sidelines and guy Urlacher and Lance Briggs talking to each other like what the hell happened out there. And so that's what those big runs can really do to you psychologically. Mark, I want to just kind of get right down to the bottom line here. I mean, the Lions don't have a running game. They didn't really have one before Jabba Best got hurt, although he certainly could provide it in spurts. But now as you look at the remaining nine games, the 5-2 start notwithstanding, can this team win enough games to make a playoff run without any semblance of a running game?
Yeah, I mean, when they were 5-0, I said even if they went 500, they're still a playoff team. And I don't think this is a team that's going to lose out like we saw a couple of years back when they started 6-0. This is a very good team. And they're in a rough spot right now. They're not nearly as good as the media was hoping they'd be for the storyline purposes. They're still a very good team. I think they're more than good enough to finish second in the NFC North. They're more than good enough to finish high in the wild card race. If they barely miss out on the wild card, of course it will be a disappointment, but it will be a huge step forward from previous seasons. So this still is not, at 5-2, this is still not a team to feel bad about. And this is a team that has correctable errors that, whether they correct or not, are not things that you're not going to blow this team up. This is not Matt Millen where we need to fire the coaching staff because we're going to have a high draft pick again. This is a team that is now the middle of the bunch, and we need to figure out how to get that next step to get to the top of the bunch and to get to that playoff run mode. But, we shouldn't have overreacted after 5-0, and we shouldn't overreact after 0-2 either, because if you would have told me, this is such a cliche, but if you would have told me at the beginning of the season that we'd start 5-2, I'd have laughed in your face and said, "Oh, probably more like three and four." But just because they got to 5-2 doesn't make, or just because they got to 5-0 doesn't make 5-2 less of an accomplishment. This is a team that won nine straight. You have to give that to them. This is a team that's coming off just a couple of atrocious seasons under Schwartz, and before that, Rod Marinelli and the Matt Millen regime. This is a team that's taken steps forward, and just because they're stumbling on this current step doesn't mean that they're still not going forward. If anything, you want to see a little bit of this adversity so they can learn from it, because sometimes teams have real adversity. This is some adversity that they've created with their own bad play. But you need to see a team beat adversity to get through an NFL season. That's just how this league is built. And so, again, just because this is a stumble doesn't mean it's a huge stumble backward. I think we're still seeing a team that's growing up, a team that's getting better. And you know what? If they played that same game against the San Francisco 49ers 10 times, I think they might win that game 5 out of 10 times. And you can say the same thing about the game this past week. Just because they lost on this given Sunday doesn't mean they would lose to that same team again. And I think it's important to realize that they haven't been outclassed this season. They know how to win games. They know how to win close games, and they know how to win blowouts. They know how to maximize their talent. It's really upsetting that they lost two in a row, but let's not overblow it. It is what it is, and we're still 5-2 and one of the top teams in the NFC.
Well, Mike Schotte of SportsGeeksRadio.com's Average Joe Sports Show and, of course, Bleacher Report. Mike, I would submit to you that you don't have to look any further than within your own division to see maybe the best team in the entire NFL, the Green Bay Packers. And when you see them up close, you see them, of course, twice a year. You see them play other teams, and you see how they just completely zoomed past the Vikings after falling behind a little bit in the first half, and how talented they are. Truly, can you look at the Lions and then look at the Packers and see? I mean, you still got it. Don't you, as good as you think the Lions might be right now, don't you still see a considerable gap between them and the Packers?
Absolutely, but I put a considerable gap between the Packers and everyone else. Before this season, a lot of people were talking about what the Philadelphia Eagles had done. A lot of people were talking about the high-priced names that the New England Patriots had done, and I looked around and said, guys, the Super Bowl champions are healthy. They didn't do much, but they just won a championship and got about 12 guys off IR that are better than what they won a championship with. This is a phenomenally deep team. They've suffered some big injuries this year, just like last, and it's almost like they didn't happen because they're still playing top football. And again, I'll just go back. Aaron Nagler, who works for owns Cheesehead TV, wrote a guest column for me today for Bleacher Report saying that Aaron Rodgers is playing better football than anyone on the planet right now. And I absolutely agree with him. Aaron Rodgers is the reason the Packers are who they are. He is more valuable to the Packers today than Brett Favre was to the Packers 10 years ago. And I mean that seriously, because Aaron Rodgers doesn't make mistakes. He is so careful with the football, and he has the ability to spread it around. As great as Brett Favre was, and I'm not saying that Rodgers is a better quarterback than Favre was, but I'm saying that right now, in a vacuum, this season, Rodgers is playing better football than Favre ever did for this stretch dating back to last year's playoffs. And if he can keep this up, he's in rarefied air. People are starting to mention, Mike McCarthy mentioned today, that he's the most heady QB that he's been around since Joe Montana. And it's absolutely true that this guy hears so much about the football and he did so many crazy things with the football. He feels pressure. He has that internal clock that we talked about Stafford needs to find. And he's got so many weapons around him, from a great receiving core to JerMichael Finley to a couple of running backs in Ryan Grant and James Starks that can get the job done, even though they're not phenomenal. And they've got an offensive line that can get the job done, even though they're not a top offensive line in the league. But they work together. And that's just talking about the offense. The defense is phenomenal as well, and Dom Capers always has them in the position to win. So as much as it stinks that they're in the same position as the Lions, you hate to use that as the only measuring stick, because since the Green Bay Packers are far and away the best team in football, and no one's even close. And as far as the way as the Lions look, they're just as far away as everyone else is.
Well, the way that the Packers closed out that Vikings game yesterday with just running the ball right down the Vikings' throat when everybody in the building knew that that's what they were going to do. Starks was unbelievable. The offensive line was unbelievable. That's the mark of a championship team, is doing it when everybody expects you to do it and still doing it anyway. And that's what the way they closed that game down just completely completely nailed it, put the nail in the coffin there. Was pretty impressive. And Troy Aikman said on that telecast, I think he said that we're being treated right now to some of the best quarterback play the league has ever seen. And that's coming from a guy, of course, who was an elite quarterback in his day. We just have a couple minutes left. Al, what's your deal? Do you have anything left for Mike Schottet before we let him go?
Yeah, I just want to touch on the Jahvid Best injury. He suffered two concussions this year. Obviously, there was the horrific one he suffered at Cal. Do you think there's talk going around that he's being pushed by people in his inner circle, probably family, to take the rest of the year off to recover from the concussions? What do you think is going to end up happening? Do you think there is something to that, that maybe he might be best off to take some serious time off away from football?
Absolutely. If I'm Jahvid Best, or I love Jahvid Best because I'm in his inner circle of family and friends, that's the same advice I would be giving him. People have this absurd notion that this last one was a minor concussion, and I like the line that I'm blatantly stealing right now, that a minor concussion is kind of like a minor pregnancy.
Yeah.
So when you have one, you have one, period. It's not minor or major. And one of the other comparisons I like is, let's stop calling it a concussion, because we have this idea that a concussion can be major or minor. Let's just call it what it is. It's brain damage.
Yeah.
You don't have minor brain damage. Your brain is damaged. Sit down. And when players have a concussion, they fight to get back in the game. And I think Jahvid Best has it in him that he wants to get back to the game. And obviously, the Lions need him and want him back. But absolutely, if I'm in his inner circle of friends, I'm saying, you have brain damage. Sit down. This doesn't make you less of a man. This doesn't mean that the team can't depend on you in the future. Because if anything, this is a player that the Lions drafted in the first round. They traded up to get him. They don't want him for this year. They want him for the next 10. And concussions have a cumulative effect. And if he can sit down, get healthy, get right, and be healthier in the long term, that's probably better for his career and also better for him, his post-career life. And so, of course I want him back as a fan.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I know that he wants to get back as a player and the team wants him back as such a dangerous weapon. But if he sits out, I don't think you can begrudge the man that, because, again, there's no such thing as a minor concussion. And if unless you've had one and your entire livelihood and family's livelihood is based on your health, your ability to play a very dangerous game, that another concussion can come at any minute, don't begrudge the man, whatever his decision is. Again, I hope he's back, but if he makes a decision the other way, more power to him, and bless him on his way.
Well, I've had some people in my inner circle say that I've got brain damage, so I can kind of relate to what Jahvid Best might be going through. Mike Schottet.
Hey, that was off
you.
The record. Come on.
You promised you'd never tell. Mike Schottet, terrific to have you again, as usual. We always like having you on. We enjoy it. The 45 minutes. You know what, Al? I don't know if the 45 minutes goes by any faster than when we have Mike Schottet on. That's no disrespect to Matt Hutter and Vinny Goodwill and some of the other guys we've had on the program, but it seems like whenever we have Mike on, I look at the clock at 7:15, I look at it again at 7:30, and look at it again at 7:45. Just that quickly, it's amazing. Mike, thanks again, and let's have you back on. And congratulations again for that recognition you got by the National Pro Football Writers.
Yeah, thank you very much. And for two visits in a row, if Big Al doesn't get this birthday thing, I'm going to explode, because this one was just easy.
That's right. Last time you were kind of getting on his case. That's right. I forgot about that. Well, we'll see how he does on the next clue here. But thanks again, Mike, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Mike.
I think you guys have a great night.
All right.
You too. Okay, and as Mike said, the first clue to whose birthday is it. I was born on this date in 1926 in Marshall, Texas. I was a first-round draft pick in 1948 as a quarterback by the old Baltimore Colts of the All-American Football Conference, which started me on my way to my seven-time Pro Bowl career. I threw seven touchdown passes on October 26, 1962, and I also, unfortunately, though, am the only NFL quarterback to be in the Hall of Fame who has never won a postseason game.
Well, I got to be honest with you, the seven touchdown passes gave it away. And actually, Mike's right. This is one I probably should have had at the first one, but this one convinced that that's got to be about probably the quarterback who had the most iconic NFL picture ever taken of him.
Yes.
And that is a one Y.A. Tittle.
Absolutely. I was going to mention the iconic photograph as well as my next clue, but I certainly wasn't going to give away the teams he played for because that would have really done it. San Francisco and the Giants, of course, after he left Baltimore. But yes, Y.A. Tittle, also known as, or his real name, his God-given name, not God-given, but his parent-given name, I'm in bad light here, Al. Let me go to get into some better light. His real name is Yelburton Abraham. Yelburton Abraham Tittle is 85 years old today, so happy birthday to Y.A. Tittle. That was a fascinating stat that I read. He's the only NFL quarterback in the Hall of Fame to never win a postseason game. And that's, of course, in his defense, not as many teams made the playoffs, number one. And there weren't all these wild cards and all this other, so he didn't get a lot of as many opportunities maybe as some other players did to even make the playoffs. Because you know back then you won 9-10 games, you still couldn't get in. But Y.A. Tittle, of course, you mentioned that iconic shot of him with his helmet off and the blood streaming down his head,
right.
And absolutely iconic. And the funny thing about that photo, I was reading about that today, is that that photo was never published.
Really?
The only reason it became iconic. I think it was the, I'm not sure which newspaper failed to, I want to say what happened in Pittsburgh, it was taken in Pittsburgh. The reason that they did not run it was they thought it was a little bit too stark, and so they ran another photo. But the reason it became iconic is because the photographer who took the photo entered it into a contest.
Yeah.
And that's where it became, that's where it saw the light of day. So that's why we all have seen it over and over and over again, and it's a great photo. You're listening to The New Jerks. I'm Greg Eno from GregEno.com, and, of course, Big Al Beaton from the Wayne Fonts Experience, WayneFonts.com. Next Monday, I will not be here. I will be replaced by guest co-host Adam Biggers, and Adam and Al will welcome Lee Panis of Detroit Tiger Tales and another Tigers blogger to be determined to talk about the Tigers offseason and kind of take a look back at what happened in 2011. That's next week. And November 7th, when I come back, we'll try to get Jamie Samuelson to hook up with us as well. So let's continue on, Al. We, as usual, at this time of the year when we've got so much stuff going on, and that's with Michigan not even playing this weekend.
Yeah.
I know you got some stuff in the hopper, so let's get to it.
Yeah, it's... between the Lions playing, which Mike has pretty much covered all the bases for the most part. And, then, of course, there was the wild game out at in East Lansing Saturday night of the Spartans taking out the Wisconsin Badgers. And I don't know what's in the air in East Lansing at night games anymore, but whenever they're nationally televised at night, they have there's just these wild endings of trick plays and such, or as the case may be, this rocket play, the Hail Mary. And, of course, the Red Wings. We haven't touched much on the Red Wings beginning of the season just because there's been so much going on with the Lions season getting off to a good start and, of course, the Tigers making the playoffs. So the Red Wings really, which is rare in this area, have really taken a back seat. And even it's even more surprising considering they were off to a very fast start as well. And we'll try and touch a little bit on the Red Wings rumors about going to the East. Obviously, we'll touch on, we're going to maybe at least give our opinions on what's going on in the NBA and Major League Baseball right now as well. But, Greg, before we move on to the Spartans game, I just wanted to ask you, what's your take on all the kerfuffle over the Lions being a dirty team, especially after yesterday's game? Roddy White, or as Ngedomagun Sue called him today, Rodney White. And was essentially called out the Lions for taking cheap shots at their quarterback and kicking him while he was injured. And, of course, photos came out today. You know, people actually watched the play in question. And of course, you know, screenshots. And it was nothing of the sort. So, and obviously, Ndamukong Suh said, I don't care about Rodney White's respect. And he said, I would never do that. After the game yesterday, after it broke in the – essentially, it was the Atlanta paper and Pro Football Talk was the two sites that brought up the allegations. Cliff Avril went to Twitter and essentially called BS on him as well. And I just think trash talking going on both sides. Things were exaggerated, specifically the claims by the Falcons, which when you start exaggerating like that, that can also put everything else you say into question, which is what's happening now. But, I think the one thing that bothers me is Ndamukong Suh saying, well, it's karma as to why Matt Ryan hurt his ankle. And I think Ndamukong Suh, for as much as I like the kid, and as good of a player as he is, sometimes I wish he would – I think he needs to – I won't say he needs to keep his mouth shut as much. I think sometimes he just says a little too much of what he's really thinking, if you know what I mean. And I think everything he said up to that point I was in total agreement with. I just thought the karma comment was just a little bit over the top.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of odd as well. You know, we've talked about Sue and about how he's becoming an NFL darling. You know, he's a media darling. You know, if you looked at the videotape of him with that karma comment, by the way, today, you saw all the microphones in his face. I mean, you know, he was just swarmed by the media. This is the kind of a player that is going to warrant that kind of attention. He's going to kind of be the guy that you go to after a game if you're a reporter. And I can see it brewing. He's not there yet, but he's going to be one of these guys that is going to give you a rock'em sock'em quote for the next day's paper. I mean, he's just that kind of a. I think that's what's coming here.
Yeah,
he's not a dumb guy at all by any stretch of imagination. He's well spoken. As a matter of fact, he's actually kind of soft spoken considering how.
I've met him in a press conference before, and he was it's a total 180 from what you would think he would be. What you see on the field, in person, he's mild mannered and was nice as can be. And I could not believe the patience the man had in going around meeting people. So to hear him talk like this in front of reporters, you're right. I think that at the very least, I like players that speak their minds, because really, there's far too many athletes who. Just speaking cliches, just sometimes that when you do speak your mind, you're going to make mistakes.
Well, you know what? These defensive guys, Al, in the NFL, and this has been going on since the days of Alex Karras and Merlin Olsen.
Oh, yeah.
They have these split personalities.
Yeah.
When you get them outside of the realm of football, they're jovial, they're nice, they're mild-mannered. You know, Merlin Olsen... You know, you couldn't have gotten much more mild mannered than Roland Olsen.
Yeah.
But when you get these guys on the football field or in a football environment, they become different people. And that's what I think Sue was today. Sue was not on the field.
Yeah.
He was in his locker room, in his football element, if you will, his lair, if you will. And here are the media surrounding him. And, you know, he knows that he's the guy that people come to, and he's always the center of attention. Now he had another personal foul yesterday. He had that vicious that face mask which tore Matt Ryan's head off, and of course he's in the center of attention with this supposed trash talk of Matt Ryan. But you know, so that's to be expected. This is the kind of a guy that you're going to take some of what he says with a grain of salt. You're going to roll your eyes. It's going to be kind of a Shaquille O'Neal, Charles Barkley kind of a thing, where you call, there he goes again, there goes Sue again. You know, and that's what we're going to eventually say as he gets more and more a veteran in the league. But let's put this in perspective now. Matt Ryan wasn't exactly, Al, carted off the field on a stretcher.
No,
okay,
he wasn't.
It wasn't like he was out. He's not like he's out for the season. It's not like his career's in jeopardy. He came back a few plays later. So let's keep things in perspective about how hurt this guy may have been. And and as far as trash talk, you know, hey, you got to have a little bit of a thick skin to play this game. I'm inclined to think that what Roddy White said, that there's an element of truth to it, because I don't know why you would make that up, especially after winning a football game.
Right.
I mean, you know, if you win a football game, I don't know why you would then feel inclined to make up stuff like that. So I'm inclined to think that some of the stuff that he said was true. Now, did he embellish it? We don't know, because we'll never know. But I'm inclined to think that some of what he said, there's an element of truth to it. But if that's the case, you know, again, Matt Ryan, now this would be a lot more to me. Of a bigger story, if Matt Ryan was done for the year or was carved off the field in a stretcher or something like that, this guy, okay, got up on his own power, got off the field, and came back a couple of plays. I don't think he missed, like, more than two plays. So we're not really talking about some sensational injury. It wasn't the Joe Theismann. It wasn't like the Joe Theismann injury.
It looked a lot worse than it really ended up being.
Right, yeah, and I know at the time, when it first happened, you didn't know that he was going to be that minor. But, you know, but I know you mentioned Cliff Averill took to Twitter. you know, vehemently denying what was said by Roddy White. You know, it's funny how the Lions seem to be at last weekend was the thing with Harbaugh and Schwartz.
Yep.
Now it's this thing with the trash talk with the Falcons, and before that, of course, there was, you know, lots of talk about Sue being a dirty player. Now it's not just Sue.
Yeah.
Now it's not just Sue. It's now the whole team is now starting to get this, supposedly has this reputation now. And I don't know if it's other teams, Al, that are trying to give the Lions that reputation, or just kind of like piling on, to use a football term,
right,
or if this is really genuine stuff. But either way, the NFL, the world of the NFL, as you know,
mm-hmm,
the world is 7 days long. In the NFL, the world is 7 days long. And
yep,
and you go out the next Sunday, and it's a whole different – your world can change in 7 days. It's amazing how this league works. It's fascinating how you can be so high, and the fan base can be so high after 1 week and so down the next. And that's what – I think Mike Schottie made a great point when he said that the Sue thing and the Schwartz thing both came after losses.
Yeah. Yeah, very, very good point in that. You're right. If the Lions win next week and beat Tim Tebow, then everybody forget all about this, unless
right,
something else happens. Like, if someone hurts poor Tim Tebow, and God forbid, no pun intended.
Literally
yeah.
Literally
all right. With that out of the way, let's talk a little bit about Michigan State. And obviously, I thought a rocket was, something that takes a payload up into space, but it turns out a rocket is actually a Hail Mary from Kirk Cousins to Keith Nichol that bounces off a handful of Wisconsin defenders, and then you fall in, and then you struggle to barely cross the plane of the end zone. But that was one. It was one hell of an entertaining game. It really was. And I don't know what's in the air at East Lansing in these night games, but it does something to Mark D'Antonio, for one thing. That all these some of these plays just come out of nowhere, and it was literally a miracle win. It was a huge win, a hell of a win for Michigan State for many ways. One, it really gives them the inside track to win the – I have no idea what division they're in, but whatever, the legend leaders, I don't really care. They're leading the division. They have the inside track to the Big Ten title game, and realistically, a lot of people call them the Rose Bowl favorite now, considering they beat what was thought to be the best team in the Big Ten, Wisconsin. So – if anything, this is the year for Michigan State. Ohio State's down. Michigan's still trying to recover from the Rich Rodriguez era, and they look to be at least a couple years away from really even coming, getting to Michigan State's level at this point, as we saw a couple weeks ago. So this is the year for Michigan State to finally make a BCS bowl. They probably won't make the it's going to take a lot of things to happen, a lot of dominoes to fall for them to even get a sniff of the national title game. But for Michigan State to make a BCS bowl, I would think they would have to be the favorite in the Big Ten right now to make it to the Rose Bowl. And considering where Spartans were a few years ago and where they are now, I think it's you can't go without question. They are the dominant football program in the state of Michigan, and I don't think neither one of us would have said that 10 years ago that would ever happen.
Well, you know, one of the things we talked about with the Spartan program, Al, was, okay, how are they going to follow up the 2010 season? You know, that was always the question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had a great 2010, obviously, mm-hmm, but it was like, okay, now what?
Yeah.
You know, now what? But here's the thing. You mentioned, going to Lions, going to Denver and beating Denver, and everybody's going to forget about, you know, all this stuff. But
what
if the Spartans go to Nebraska and lose?
Yeah.
Now, Nebraska is in their division, where the Badgers are not.
Right.
So as big of a win as that was over Wisconsin in terms of its excitement and the fact that it was a team that was ranked number four in the country and the fact that it came on the last play of the game is really, I hate to be, to rain in the parade here, but really won't mean a whole lot because they've got to beat Nebraska. That's the team that you got to beat the teams in your own division first and foremost, or else you don't get a chance to play for the championship. So they have to go to Nebraska, which is obviously no picnic,
mm-hmm,
and they have to win a football game somehow. And if they don't, this Wisconsin win is just going to go down. It's going to be exciting, and people are going to remember it. But it's just not. It's going to be canceled out, and really more than canceled out by a lost to Nebraska because Nebraska's in their own division. Not to mention the fact that, of course, it will be their second loss of the season.
Right.
You know, can they run the table? Yeah, they can get past Nebraska. They got a great shot.
Yeah,
running the table.
That's the big roadblock. But they should run the table. But isn't that always been the question with the Spartans, that can they handle Prosperity?
Well, look what happened to them in Iowa last year. That's what, you know, they could go down to Nebraska next week. And, you're still not sure. And I think that's what we're talking about and what you're talking about. You're still not sure what's really going to happen down there. You think that they've got a good shot at it. You think they've got a good football team. And they do. But there's still a distrust, I think, there that says, well, you know, they've done this to us before. They've led us down this path before. And look what they did in the bowl game last year. Against Alabama. Obviously, they shouldn't have been on the same field with Alabama, as it turned out. But nobody really thought of that. I mean, there were a few people that were the actual realists that said, you know, Michigan State's going to get smoked by Alabama, and they were right. But, you know, we don't know. I mean, this Nebraska game, if they win this one, they should win out.
Yeah.
They should, because their schedule is very favorable at that. For the most part, pretty favorable. But that was a big win, obviously. Clearly the game was tied, so, you know, it would have been overtime. They may still have won it in overtime. We'll never know. But anytime you win a game like that, I mean, that's just very thrilling, obviously.
Yeah, and in the Spartans' credit, that they have been on quite a stretch. I mean, say what you will about the status of the programs. We're talking Michigan State has now beat back-to-back-to-back Ohio State, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Say what you will about the status of Ohio State and Michigan. Ohio State and Michigan are rivalry games, especially Michigan. That's the game of the year for the Spartans. And to beat those three teams in the way they have, and for the most part, especially Michigan, they just dismantled Michigan. And Wisconsin was the number four team in the country. Say what you will. I mean, I do have issues with Michigan State. Specifically, I have issues with Mark D'Antonio, especially when it comes to the way he handles discipline of that team and some of the – in my mind, I think D'Antonio he seems like Trussell Jr., and that really kind of bothers me, just that vibe about him. But there's no question that right now he has the Spartans playing at a very high level. And really, it's going to come down to the Nebraska game. And you said it's not a gimme, you know. Winning at Nebraska is definitely an accomplishment, but to say if the Spartans run a gauntlet of a schedule of Ohio State, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Nebraska, I don't know what more to say about the Spartans than, yeah, they deserve every accolade they're getting if they can beat Nebraska.
Well, yeah, it's like what Mike Schotte said about, you know, would you have taken the Lions at 5-2 before the season? Well, of course you would have. Would you have taken the Spartans to win all those games you're talking about, Ohio State, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Nebraska? If they, you know, would you take that? Of course you would. Absolutely. That's what makes the college football season, even though there's only 12 games.
Yeah.
And even though you start usually with the cupcake schedule, there always seems to be that one game you just regret. And obviously right now it's the Notre Dame game, obviously.
Yeah.
It's one of those games that you just kind of gnash your teeth and you say, gosh darn it, we beat all these other big-name schools, and we couldn't close the deal against Notre Dame. But you know what? If they can get out of this thing, with one loss, and follow it up after what they did last year, then, of course, it becomes, as we've said, once again said on this program, can Mark D'Antonio win a bowl game?
Yep.
That's the next thing now. You know, he's starting to get this Bo Schembechler thing now, where he can't win a bowl game, and that's the next thing now. I mean, you know, this is it's good stuff right now. This is great for the program. It's a lot of fun right now. What's going on over there? But can he win a bowl game? That's I know it's early. We're not even out of October yet. But I mean, if they beat Nebraska, there really is nothing else to talk about, really, other than what bowl are they going to go to? How many wins are they going to get?
Mm-hmm.
And what are they going to do once they get to that bowl game? And that's something that Mark D'Antonio, that's still a dragon that he has yet to slay.
Yeah, it's. Then again, I guess you could say that. Yeah, it's. I won't call it his. At this point, I wouldn't say it, for with D'Antonio, it's a monkey on his back because he really hasn't been there that long, and he did have to rebuild the Spartan program. But yeah, that's a good call, especially after last year's bowl debacle. And you're right, Michigan State shouldn't have been on the same field as Alabama. It was a complete mismatch. So it's but let's not forget though, they also got to play Iowa, and that's, say what you will about Iowa, that's never, they got to play at Iowa, and that's never an easy. An easy victory, as we saw last year, but it's really weird that, and especially here in southeastern Michigan, where we're both located, and this is so heavily, really pro Michigan Wolverines. I mean, that's just how it is, and the vast majority. Well, it's always been in the state of Michigan for the most part. Fandom goes like this: you're a Michigan Wolverines fan, unless you went to Michigan State. And then if you went to Michigan State, well, then you happen to be a Spartans fan. And for years, the Spartans have had that little, I don't know, a chip on the shoulder or that grudge, you know, because they're the ones that came up with the Walmart Wolverine that the vast majority of the Michigan fan base didn't actually graduate from the school and that kind of thing. But, you know, that. But then again, you can say that about any big-time major program, especially those in the SEC. But I guess that's what makes this all the more satisfying for Spartans fans, is that they've become the dominant program in the state. And I don't know about how you think about this. You know, say what you will about Brady Hoke, about what he's done in Michigan. He really does, after seeing what happened against Michigan State this year and how well Michigan State is playing over the last few weeks, Michigan really has their work cut out for them when it comes to becoming the dominant program in the state again. I don't know if we're ever going to see the dynamic where it was all Michigan State as it was when Duffy Doherty was running the Spartans in the 60s, and then it became all Michigan for essentially 40 years, you know, with the bowl lineage. But I guess when it comes down to this, wouldn't it be nice if that Michigan and Michigan State were both playing at a very, very high level, instead of how it usually seems to be that one's way down and one's way up?
Well, you know, you had some moments under George Perlis where the Spartans with Lorenzo White and those
the
guys.
The World Bowl year.
Right, and they had some good football teams in the late 80s, early 90s, and, you know, they looked to be on their way a little bit. But here's what's going on right now. Michigan has done very well in the recruiting aspect of it, and mainly because Brady Hoke has had something which Mark D'Antonio, because of his success, hasn't had as much of, and that's playing time. He can sell playing time more than Mark D'Antonio can at certain positions. And when you can do that, you can recruit pretty good anyway. And then you can do that. Then it becomes, okay, now I've got my guy. I've got some people here. Mm-hmm. Now, they may not be they may need some coaching. But I can get them to the school, and I can start to, bring this team under my, cast them under my personality, and put my stamp on them. That's what Brady Hoke has been able to do, at least in his first recruiting class, and when he kind of smoked Michigan State. Now, people, I think, made a lot of that, but I really wasn't surprised by that. Number one, because I think Brady Hoke's a pretty good recruiter, and number two, I think that he had all the. People would say, geez, you know, you would think that the Rich Rodriguez thing would taint Michigan. But no, I think when you're following that kind of a situation, you're the kind of a guy that Brady Hoke is, who lives and breathes Michigan football, that's a perfect the soil is very fertile for you to go in there and to really do some damage in the recruiting. Now what he's got to do is he's got a very small window of time to – he may have one more year where he can out-recruit D'Antonio.
Right.
But now he's got to, once he gets the kids here, now he's got a very short window of time to make this thing happen, or else he's going to lose that recruiting edge.
Yeah.
Right now, if you want to play in a BCS bowl game, if you want to play on New Year's Day and everything, all that other stuff, you're going to go to Michigan State.
Yep.
But if you want to play and you really want to make your mark on a program, you know, maybe Michigan is more attractive to you, depending what player you are and what position you play. But you know, it is. You're right. There haven't been too many years where both schools have been dominant for sustained stretches.
Right.
You know, Michigan was, of course, good for so many years, and Michigan State would bob up and down below, up and below the surface, with a couple of exceptions. But yeah, it would be. You know, well, I think really, Al, I mean, what this
mm-hmm.
what's happened, whether or not Michigan and Michigan State are on the same level in terms of national prominence, if nothing else, the Michigan-Michigan State game has become something that is interesting, because now you've got a little four-game winning streak now by Michigan State. That's never happened in about 40
yeah.
years, 50 years. And now you've got a, that's a little subplot to the whole thing. And so if nothing else, it makes the Michigan-Michigan State game, you know, important, because, you know, before it was like, well, Michigan's probably going to win, and they would usually win. Now it's Michigan, it's about to graduate an entire class that has never beaten Michigan State. And that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. For years it was like, oh, Michigan State, oh, it's like Michigan playing Minnesota or Indiana, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Nine times out of ten, Michigan's going to win. So it's that's refreshing as heck. But I got to ask you one thing about Michigan State, Greg. The pro combat uniforms. I thought it was Baylor on the goddamn field. Instead of, you know, with the gold helmets and the I know. I guess what it is when it comes, and for that matter, Michigan looked like bumblebees, for Christ's sake, in the uniforms they had. But I guess the thing is the kids, as I say, because we're way out of that demographic, obviously. For some reason, they really seem to dig these alternative, Oregonization of college football uniforms. When I saw Michigan State play in those Nike Pro Combat unis, I'm like, am I sure I'm watching Michigan State, or am I watching an old Southwestern Conference game from like 1985? So, I guess, and of course, I have issues with the Michigan unis as well, because they aren't even throwbacks, for Christ's sake. They're retro-themed, you know, I'll take that,
yeah.
because Michigan's uniforms have rarely ever changed, but I don't know, Greg. Call me a curmudgeon. Call me old school like yourself. But those pro combat uniforms just bug me for some reason. And anybody who's under 25, over 25, because they like them, I think they're lying.
I didn't like them for sure, mainly because it didn't look like Michigan State.
Huh?
It didn't look like Michigan State. Like you said, yeah, Baylor's a good – I didn't think about Baylor, but that's a good one. I thought Oregon or something like that. This isn't – when I first turned the game on when they were playing Michigan, because I forgot they were going to wear those uniforms.
Yeah.
I said, what? Who
yeah.
are those guys out there?
Yeah.
It just didn't seem like a Michigan-Michigan State game. It's because it's funny how just the uniform should really – mean that much, but
yeah.
they do in this case, because you know you're so used to seeing the green and white out there, and the mm-hmm. You know, the Sparty on the helmet, and or the block S or whatever you're going to use, and you know, the Michigan State words across the chest, and
right.
you know, you're so used to that, and then here they come out with these like you said, you know, these Baylor looking type uniforms and the gold helmets, which was, you know, smacks of Notre Dame. And,
right.
you know, and there was a Spartan logo, I think, on there, but it was very, you know.
Yeah, it was hard to
very,
tell. Yeah.
Hard to tell. And, no, I didn't like him either. I'm like you, though. I don't like the – I'm not a big fan of the, you know, pro combat, whatever they call those things, the whatever those things are called. I don't like them. That you mentioned Oregonization. I think that's a good word. I don't like those uniforms. But I don't like that stuff. I'm more of a traditionalist. Give me an Alabama, give me a Nebraska,
yeah.
give me a Michigan, give me a Penn State, give me a, you know, even a Notre Dame, I hate to say it, but, I mean,
yeah.
just give me some uniforms where as soon as I turn the – what
I
like
watching.
Is as soon as
–
right. As soon as I turn on the game, I know who's playing. And it seems like college football anymore, or college sports in general, because basketball changes uniforms a lot too,
mm-hmm.
they just don't – have there's, and there's no continuity – except for the big-time programs. The big-time
yeah.
programs have been pretty true to their traditional roots, and the same Alabama uniforms you see now are pretty much the same uniforms that you saw when Bear Bryant was coaching them. And
yeah.
I like that. I like the fact that the Tigers wear the same home uniforms that Charlie Gehringer wore. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I like that. You know, some people might
yeah.
say, you know, like you know, call us, like you said, curmudgeons. But I think there's something to that. You know, the Dodgers uniform, you know. I mean, there's certain uniforms that are just the Yankees, of course, that just scream, you know, you just know who they are, and they never change. And the Red Wings, I'm glad the Red Wings have never fallen into that trap of having a third alternate jersey, except when they play those, like if they play like a Winter Classic or something like that.
Right.
They've never gone into that, you know, having that third weird jersey like some of these other NHL teams have done, which have been kind of bizarre looking, and I don't like those either, frankly. I find myself, Al, I know we're getting off tangent here, but I find myself enjoying the old-look uniforms. I find myself really enjoying the looks of 30, 40 years ago. Whenever, like, I'm so glad the Jets, for example, went back to their Joe Namath-type uniforms.
Yeah, that logo special.
Yeah, and I like when, you know, the Chargers went to, like, the occasionally wear those baby blue.
Those are my all-time favorite uniforms, by the way, the baby blue Chargers uniforms.
Yeah, the days of Lance Allworth and John Hadle and... I just like that whole thing. I like the Bruins went. Boston Bruins went back to their traditional type thing. And I saw the Vikings yesterday playing the Packers, and they went back to their traditional. What I remember them wearing back in the 70s and 80s. And you know, I just think that they just look better. I just think that the uniforms back then would just look better, frankly.
Yeah.
I think that the Seattle Seahawks, I thought they had outstanding uniforms with those silver helmets and the big Seahawk and the silver pants and the big white numbers, and their uniforms look like trash.
Yeah, it's and it's funny, especially when you talk when you bring it up in the college way in the college realm. For the most part, the teams that especially that are really going crazy with the different uniforms and the alternate colors and things like that are, I guess you could call them the nouveau riche of the college football. Oregon is one of them. You know, because as you mentioned, most of the teams, almost all the teams that you mentioned that have these iconic uniforms that they don't mess with have been powers in one sport or another for decades upon decades. And it's usually, as you said, it's the interlopers, the newer teams, like the Oregons, who are, well, we got to do something to stand out. We got to do something different.
Right.
Or look at, or for that matter, look at Boise State and the blue turf. And they've started something with that now, where, you know, there's a local high school team not far from here, Oxford, has blue freaking turf. A high school team. You know,
yeah.
You know, so it's, I guess, Greg, we're just showing our age here. But, leave this stuff alone and yeah, you're right. In some, but then again, you know, a lot as you brought up, some of the uniforms that we love, like the name of Jets and the logo of that era, or the Lance Allworth Chargers, were when we were kids. So I guess it's all when you grow up. But as you brought up, speaking of teams that have never ever ever changed their uniforms, and let's never ever talk about people who wore a black Detroit Red Wings sweater. I mean, I hate those, but we got to talk about the Red Wings. The Red Wings are off to a very fast start, 5-1. They got 10 points leading the division. They lost their first game of the season over the weekend to the Capitals. It was a blowout, 7-1, and yeah, they were probably overdue for a bad performance. Anyway, no one's too uptight about it, but they really are flying underneath the radar in the area right now, which really goes to show, one, that no matter what people call it, this hockey town per se, you know, we all know it's a marketing thing, but you know, most everybody in this area is a fan of one way or another of the Red Wings. But realistically, you know, it's Tigers and Lions, and then everybody, and for that matter, you could probably throw in Michigan Wolverines and then everybody else. And even though the Wings are playing so damn well, and Nick Lidstrom hit a 1500 game he just played in, which we'll bring up a little bit later. It's really shocking how far under the radar the Detroit Red Wings are right now. I mean, the first game of the season I actually watched, at least a little bit of, was Saturday. And, of course, I ended up turning – at least I watched a little bit before Michigan State game got interesting, and plus the World Series was on. But, anyways, I wasn't missing much. But that really kind of goes to show that how far – you know, people – then again, I guess this would all lead into, well, the season's too long, and the Red Wings shouldn't be playing in October anyway. But as good as the Red Wings are, and they're a perennial contender, it's really surprising to see no one's paying attention to them right now. No one.
No, I mean, relatively speaking, they really aren't. There isn't a lot of chatter about the team, certainly. There's been obviously a lot to draw our attention away from them, the Tigers' playoff run and the Lions and what's going on in college football and you know, so there's a lot, you know, going on there. And so that's understandable. And I think you also probably one of the biggest factors, what you said about, you know, it is only October. It is an 82 game season.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, as much as we like to say, come, March that, boy, those games back in October, November really matter.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you're fighting for a playoff spot or you're fighting for a division or you're fighting for a playoff seed or whatever, you can point back to the games, maybe the points you kind of let go back in the early part of the year. And you can say that, and that's true. It really is true. But right now, it doesn't feel like that, obviously. And you know, the Red Wings have had, frankly, also, the other thing, Al, that hasn't really helped is they've had kind of a sporadic schedule.
Oh, definitely.
They played like Jimmy Howard mentioned it. He said, like, this reminds me of my days at Maine, where we played, you know, college schedule. We played, like, one game, you played on the weekends.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
what they do in college, and that's kind of what the Red Wings have done. They've played very few games that haven't occurred on Friday and Saturday night. And so they went, like, the first 2 weeks of the season only playing four games, and that didn't help either. Not that necessarily they would have played more games, they would have been more of a buzz, but, I mean, in terms of, you know, they weren't even really getting into it. I mean, they were getting tired of practicing against each other. All they wanted to do was play games.
Right.
And, you know, and here's this big game, Al. I mean, I think here's a good example of what you're talking about. Here's a 5-0 Red Wings team going into Washington that was 6-0.
Yeah.
Which, you know, normally would have been, even though it's early, that's a big game around here usually. And that
yeah.
just didn't get any play. It just didn't get a lot of... It just didn't, again, there's a lot going on, I understand that. And it was the same night as, you mentioned Michigan State playing and all that stuff, but, you know, that's a big game. You know, that's Ovechkin against Datsyuk. That's, you know, a potential
mm-hmm.
Stanley Cup final thing, the whole nine yards. And it just didn't get any play. And that's regardless of what the final score ended up being. And I'm just talking about the hype. Now, there wasn't
yeah.
a lot of time for the hype because the Red Wings played Friday night. They beat Columbus,
mm-hmm.
which is a bad team, and that wasn't
right.
unexpected. And then all of a sudden they turn around on a back-to-back and they got to play at Washington, which didn't help, and Washington didn't even play Friday night, so they were home and rested, you know, waiting for the Red Wings. So, but I mean, there wasn't really a lot of play about it. I mean, that's a big game in the NHL. For a league that's starved, you know, usually starved for attention, they didn't, that game just didn't. I'm surprised it wasn't on one of the national
mm-hmm.
stations, frankly, but it was... Just kind of came and went, but again, it's a long season, and I think that plays into it as well.
Oh yeah, definitely. And also going under the radar was that Nick Lidstrom, if there's a Mount Rushmore Red Wings, Lidstrom's going to definitely be on it. He hit his 1,500th game plateau Saturday night. And what's amazing about Nick Lidstrom, he's still playing, and he's still playing at an elite level, and this guy is still a
yeah.
Norris Trophy candidate every year, you know, and he's in his 40s now. But this 1,500th game, the plateau had me wondering how much longer he's going to play. He pretty much said he's year to year at this point. He doesn't want to commit to anything more than a year at a time.
Right.
And really, the idea of a Wings team without Nick Lidstrom is almost unimaginable at this point. And what's really scaring about it, that it's probably going to happen sooner or later. If it doesn't happen after this year, it can't be more in another year or two. No matter
right.
what you say about Lidstrom, I can't see him doing a Chris Chelios and playing until he's 85. So he doesn't need to. You know, he doesn't need to. And plus, he's always talked about wanting to go back home to Sweden. So what's scary about thinking about that is that for most part, when the Wings have lost their legendary players, specifically looking back at Steve Yzerman, they pretty much had already replaced Yzerman when he retired.
Right.
He was a third line, fourth line player at that point because by that point they had already developed Henrik Zetterberg, Pavel Datsyuk, and so on. But
right.
with Nick Lidstrom, you know, the Wings have some solid defensemen, but they don't have an elite defenseman. So I guess that's my fear, is that as good as the Wings are right now and as good as they are with Nick Lidstrom, my concern is when Lidstrom decides to retire, and it's going to happen, is that
right.
the Wings may really find themselves dropping a level performance-wise and I think maybe even more so than we expect.
Well, I mean, hey, did Boston ever replace Ray Bourque?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's some guys that just you don't. Now, Yzerman, I will say this, though. If you remember,
mm-hmm.
Yzerman's last year, 2005-2006, when he came back he came back from an injury around, I want to say, January, February.
Yeah.
And he was the he was, for about 2 months, the Red Wings' best player.
Mm-hmm.
He played some of his best hockey I've ever seen him play at almost age 41.
Yeah.
And it was unbelievable how well that guy was playing. He was leading he was basically putting the team on his back for about 10 games.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. But you're right. The Red Wings had, you know, it's easier to make up offense, Al,
yeah,
than it is to make up for an elite defensive player like Nick Lidstrom. You just don't do it. You just, you know, you just don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, these guys come along once in a lifetime sometimes,
yeah,
frankly. You know,
yeah.
Each franchise doesn't, sometimes each franchise doesn't even get a player like Nick Lidstrom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Boston had Ray Bourque. They had Bobby Orr. You know, the Doug Harveys of the world. I'm talking about elite defensemen. I mean,
yeah,
guys like that that just, they come along once and that's it. And you know, so you're not going to, if the Rebels are going to, fans are going to think that, okay, we need to find a guy to replace Nick Lidstrom. Not going to happen.
Right.
Not going to happen. Now, you can make up for the lack of offense that Steve Yzerman provided in the two-way play by sheer numbers. I mean, they're just by the numbers of forwards you have that can do different things, and the Red Wings have always been very good at that, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not taking anything away, of course, from what Steve Yzerman meant to the Red Wings at all.
Right.
But what I'm saying is that, you know, this is a player. Now, you're talking about Gordie Howe, Nick Lidstrom, Alex Delvecchio, and Yzerman as the four players in franchise history who've played, I think, 20 years or more with the Red Wings.
Yeah.
And no other team in the NHL, with the exception of Gordie, who played for Hartford. But so that's what you're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
And the Red Wings have been very fortunate to have that many, frankly, players
yeah.
like that, because a lot of franchises, even the Canadiens, I can't think of anybody. Can you think of anybody who played for the Canadiens for 20 years? I can't.
No, I can't. Not off the top of my head.
I don't know that they had one. I mean, I think
no.
Belleville may have played for about 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I don't think the Canadiens, as rich of a tradition as they had, they've never had a player play 20 years in the NHL for them. The Maple Leafs have never had a player play for
yeah.
20 years for them. The Bruins have never had, well, Bourque. Bourque
mm-hmm.
may have, although he did get traded to Colorado, so I'm not sure, but Bourque was close.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of players in the history of the National Hockey League that have played that long for one team. The Red Wings have four of them.
Yeah.
So that's amazing right there. But it's not going to happen. Lidstrom's not going to be replaced. All you can do, Al, is hope that guys like Cronwall, Stewart, Erickson, you know, the new crowd, if you will,
mm-hmm.
Just kind of as a unit play
at a high level. Yeah.
Right, at a high level. Because you're not going to replace Lidstrom's shot. You're not going to replace his how he can separate the guy from the puck without even, you know, touching him. You know, those kinds of things that Nick does. You know, I don't think Nick Lidstrom's blocked a shot in his entire life.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen him block a shot in his entire career.
Well, when's the last time you actually saw him hit someone hard? He's all about positioning and puck
yeah.
possession.
Right, exactly. He plays hockey like he's Bobby Fischer.
Yeah.
And he's got that kind of mentality. He sees the ice like nobody that I've ever seen before as a defenseman, with the angles, and you know he's very geometric.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing about that is that people have just got to get out of their minds that you know this guy's going to be replaced in any semblance. All you can do is just hope that the Wings have enough other guys that can kind of make up for it. But you're right. It's not a pleasant thought to think of the Red Wings without Nick Lidstrom. Frankly, I think it's a more terrifying thought
yes.
to think of the Red Wings without Nick Lidstrom than it was to think of the Red Wings without Steve Yzerman.
You're right. Exactly.
I think Steve Yzerman, and we kind of saw it coming.
Yeah,
we knew that
the injuries he had been dealing
right,
with up to that point.
Right. We knew his body just wasn't able to do it. That was the thing with Steve. But, you know, as sad as that was, and you knew it was coming because he said, this is my last year and everything, the prospects of the Red Wings without Lidstrom, to me, are scarier than the prospects of the Red Wings without Yzerman. And that's kind of a weird thing to say, considering Yzerman's the second-best player in team history. But if he is, then Lidstrom's got to be the third-best.
Yeah. Yeah, and in some ways, you can even make the argument that at least Nick Lidstrom might even be the best. In team history, just
you could,
yeah, but then again, he is a different kind of player than Gordie Howe was.
Yes,
but yeah,
right.
But you know, if you could make the argument, and you would at least have one when it, you know, when it comes. But then again, what you're right. With a team to have as many Hall of Fame level players as the Wings have had, and have played for the team for so long, that it is amazing. But yeah, I think you put it. I think you put it perfectly. When the thought is terrifying that Nick Lidstrom is not going to be on the blue line, bailing the Wings out, you know, however many times a season he does it, I mean, probably hundreds. So it's,
well, here's
go ahead.
The thing too, Al. The other thing too about Yzerman was that we always got. And I always said this, by the way, about Bill Laimbeer. I always maintained that Bill Laimbeer was the most valuable player that the Pistons had, and that was even when they had Isaiah and all those other guys. And my reasoning was, the reason why I believe that is because we've never experienced Bill Laimbeer not being on the basketball floor. Because he played all those consecutive games. I think he finally the streak was finally broken only because of the suspension. He played all those games in a row. We never had to find out. What it was like not to have Bill Laimbeer, who did so many things that were just underrated. You know, the rebounding, the passing, the outside shooting, the leadership, the ability to draw fouls from the opposing center. He did so many things that you just kind of took for granted. Now, with Yzerman, we got a taste of what it was like without Steve Yzerman, because he was injured, I remember, early on in his career with his knee.
Right.
He was hurt at various times with various injuries, and he missed large portions of a very large portion of the 2002-2003 season when he had that surgery that was mainly done on senior citizens with his knee. He's had so many, so we didn't really, it wasn't a shock to the system to not see him on the ice. But with Nick Lidstrom, that's the other thing too, is that Nick Lidstrom, we have not really had much of an opportunity to see the Red Wings play without him. Because not only has he played for 20 years, he's played almost every game for 20 years.
Yeah.
And that's what's so unbelievable. You know, if Nick Lidstrom were injury-riddled, like a Bobby Orr or Yzerman or somebody like that, and we've seen his body break down and he's missed 40, 50 games at a time, you'd say, okay, you know. But that's what's so scary about this, is that he's missed maybe two or three games at a time. That's it. And sometimes that's because they just give him the day off. So I don't know how this is going to play out, but that's what's so frightening about it, is that we don't know. We've never seen the Red Wings for 20 years without Nick Lidstrom in the lineup for any sustained length of time, which is just fascinating, really, when you think about it.
Yeah, and after this conversation, I'm ready to crawl into the fetal position. I don't want to think about this anymore. All right, before we move on from the Red Wings, there's one more topic, and that is there's more rumblings about realignment. In that, well, maybe there won't be a true realignment, just a shuffling of teams, and one of those being the Red Wings. And TSN, essentially the ESPN of Canada, columnist for them, Bob McKenzie, tweeted a few things, and essentially he put it this way: more and more NHL governors are convinced Detroit will be moving to the Southeast Division in the Eastern Conference when realignment is done in early December. If Detroit goes to the Southeast, it's plausible and possible Winnipeg would take Detroit's place in the Central. Okay, right now we're already getting kind of goofy when it comes to the realignment, as neither of these teams fit. Realignment would be done. Nothing firm yet on it. But Detroit has been a good soldier in the West for a long time. Winnipeg would be fine in the Central as opposed to the Northwest. If that happened, Dallas would be most unhappy. Stars want in the Central. All right, Greg, I got to ask you, the Southeast, sure, the Wings would be in the East, which is, I think, what everybody wants in the big scheme of things, but that is an awful fit when it comes to a geographic division. I guess the question is, sure, this would be the easy way out. I mean, this is something a lot of teams, a lot of leagues have done in the past. So, say when a team relocates, rather than actually do a true realignment, they just, you know, juggle division. You know, a little bit, and that's what they're planning on doing here, essentially switching divisions of the two teams. And I got to say, if I'm given a choice between them going to the Southeast or staying in the Central, all of a sudden I'm thinking, well, maybe the Central's preferable, don't you think?
Well, except for all those damn games out west.
Yeah, the West Coast thing is the only caveat.
Well, that's a big caveat, because once you get into the playoffs, I mean, it's not such a big deal during the regular season, because you know, even while you do play more games within your own conference, it's not incessant like it is in the playoffs where you're just you find yourself in a series against Los Angeles, for example. And, you know, we've all, you know, how many times we've talked about that. Mm-hmm. You know, first of all, I'm sure the NHL Central Division teams are just jumping for joy at the prospect of having the Red Wings replaced by Winnipeg. I'm sure they're just thrilled by that. As I say very sarcastically.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, the Red Wings. You know, I guess I would tend to disagree a little because I would just be thrilled to have them in a conference where they're not leaving the Eastern time zone very much.
Right.
I've always wanted to know how the Red Wings would do in that scenario. I think back to the New Jersey Devils and the Rangers and the Devils. You could play an entire playoff round and never a playoff run,
yeah.
I should say, and never leave the time.
Oh, that's a huge advantage to a
300-mile radius.
Yeah.
I mean, you could take a bus to the games like it was the minor leagues back.
Yeah.
And I was always wondered how the Red Wings would have done as well, as good as they've done without that advantage. I've always wondered how they would do, how life would be to be able to do that. And, of course, I've long espoused, and it's never going to happen, I've long espoused that the NHL puts all original six teams in one division.
Yeah.
I know it's never going to happen. I would love to see it. It's not going to happen. I understand that. I've resigned myself to that, as good as I think that would be for the league, and I think as good as it would be for the I think they could really use that. Just if they get the right marketing people, could really turn that into something terrific. But, of course, the danger is that you get what do you do with the other 24 teams? You got to market them as well. But
yeah.
I would just think that the Red Wings, just to get themselves out of these weird – because not only do you have – you've got the Phoenix time zone, which is 2 hours difference. You got the Colorado, the Denver thing, which is 2 hours away. You got, of course, all the California teams, which are 3 hours away. You got Vancouver, which is 3 hours away. You got Edmonton, which I think is 1 or 2 hours away. You got Calgary, which is 1 or 2 hours away. You know, I'm tired of that, frankly. And frankly, I'm tired of playing those teams.
Mm-hmm.
I would just be happy to see other teams on the schedule. Thank God the NHL relaxed their weighted, unbalanced schedule a few years ago. Remember, they used to play those teams eight times a year. The
Sixers, I know.
And the Nashville's and the Columbus's. It's like enough already. You know, I would just be thrilled to see other teams come into town, and it's almost like going from the American League to the National League in baseball, really.
Yeah.
Because I mean, at least in baseball, you've got some interleague play, and then you can see. But in hockey, you know, this, you know, 1 or 2 times a year playing these teams that really, I think, would, you know, turn the fan base on in Detroit. And if you got a chance to see Ovechkin 2 or 3 times in Detroit each year as opposed to just once or none, you know, that's, or Crosby, as much as you hate him. I mean, any of these elite players in the Eastern Conference, I think it would be great. I mean, this is all obviously very good for the Red Wings. Not so good for the Central Division because you can't replace the Red Wings market, the Red Wings – marquee value with Winnipeg. You just can't do it.
Yeah. I only argument to, I mean, I agree with the vast majority of what you're saying. I mean, I don't like the West Coast stuff. I don't like the travel the Wings have to do in the playoffs. But and if they go to the Southeast, they're still traveling 3-4 hours because they have to play Florida, Tampa Bay, and Carolina. And those aren't exactly, instead of flying across the country, you're flying south. They're almost as far, but...
But you're the
difference
same
is the
time zone. Yeah.
That's the huge difference, obviously, is the time zone. But I guess what this really leads to the question is the NHL is way overdue for a major, major realignment. And we're talking, just, you know, take all the teams into a pile and actually put them in geographical divisions that make sense. And unfortunately, because of all some of the fiefdoms that have developed over the years, you know, especially that little one over in the Atlantic Division of all these teams that are like in a 50-mile radius, at least it feels like, you know, that, and of course, then you have the Canadian contingent, and then you have the Western teams that really, if they had a choice, they want the Red Wings all themselves because it guarantees them a sellout. But the NHL really needs to say the heck with this, and we need to make sensible divisions that are fair to all of our teams, not just fair to some of them, and not just we use teams because, like, the Red Wings have been used by the NHL to prop up half the Western Conference. And that is, as good as the Wings are, that's very, very unfair to them.
You know, what the league has to do, and I know it's not easy to do, because when you are a – when you have – the feeling that you are the redheaded stepchild of the four major sports, the tendency is to want to try to please everybody.
Yeah.
Well, we know that when you have a realignment situation, that's impossible, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make all the Canadian teams happy. You can't make all the West Coast teams happy. You can't make all the Eastern Coast teams happy. You can't make all the Southern teams happy. You can't do it. So, like you said, what you have to do then is forget all that. Forget who I'm making happy, who I'm not. I mean, to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, come up with an alignment that is good for the long-term health of the league.
Right.
That's not easy to do. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that's an easy task, because it's not. There's a lot of ways, and the reason why it's not easy, Al, is because there's a lot of different ways you can go about it, and each of them, mm-hmm. maybe you could make an argument, is the correct way to go
yeah.
about it. But there's only one way to do it, obviously. You can't make everybody happy. I think what you do, though, is you have to look at, from a business sense, and this is where business has to rear its head. You can't
mm-hmm.
just dismiss business. You have to look at it from a business standpoint and say, okay, now what makes the most sense for us as a league, for the financial health of the league? What needs to happen? Or what, better yet, what do we not want to do? What do we not want to do with this alignment? Let's think about what we should not do. What are the
mm-hmm.
cardinal sins that we should not do in an alignment? I think that's maybe where you start, is that, you know, the no-brainers. You know, what do you not do?
Yeah.
And then you start to go forth. Now, this is not an easy thing, you know. I mean, I would like to see the Red Wings in the same division as Toronto, for example.
Yeah.
I would like to see them in the same division as, and Chicago. I mean, the old days of the Norris division.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
you know,
exactly.
The Red Wings and, Detroit, Chicago, Toronto, those were the days back then. Those were the terrific days back then. But, you know, I don't know. And the thing, too, is that, Al, is that these teams, the league is, with the exception of the Red Wings, who have been so good for so long,
mm-hmm.
but for the most part, the Red Wings are the exception. It's not a normal thing to have a team be elite for 20 years. It just is
right.
not.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't use the Red Wings, as much as you'd like to, you can't use them as a model. Even though they are a model franchise in terms of who would you like to be when you grow up.
Right.
But as a league, you got to understand that the league is very fluid. Teams go through, ups and downs, and they have it's like a college program. They're up
mm-hmm.
and they're down. And that it's cyclical. The Red Wings are the exception. They're not the rule. So you have to think, okay, if we're going to do this, we have to do something we're going to be able to really kind of stick to for at least 5 or 10 years, because, what we don't want to do is redo this all the time every 3 to 5 years. You can't do that. So you have to look at, you really have to just look at the whole big picture and not get too caught up in who's good right now and who's
mm-hmm.
bad right now, because I know it's tempting to do that, and you want to put all the best players so they're playing each other all the time. But and like I said, I'm being very selfish when I say put all the original six in one division. I still believe I can make a great argument to the league office as to why that would be a smart move.
Mm-hmm.
I do understand that the argument would be, okay, Greg, what about the other 24 teams? They've got to get some love too, and how are we going to market them? I understand that. But some of the great players in this league don't play for the original six teams.
Yeah.
Ovechkin and Crosby and the guys out in Vancouver and the Twins in Vancouver and the players that play for San Jose, and there's a lot of great players in the league that can be marketed that don't play for the original six. As a matter of fact, some of the original six teams are pretty down right now. Toronto's down. Montreal's pretty good, but they're not great.
Yeah.
The Rangers are down. I mean, so it's not like I'm talking. I'm saying take the original six. I'm not saying it in the same breath. That's not the same as saying the six best teams in the league. Oh, the six most exciting teams in the league. It's not. It would be very exciting for people like me who remembers the NHL in those days and,
mm-hmm.
and would, as a marketing tool, if you want to talk about throwbacks and retro, we're very caught up in throwbacks and retro stuff. I saw a commercial for NHL 2012
mm-hmm.
where they were taking players like Gordie Howe and Chris Chelios and putting them for different teams. I saw Gordie Howe in a Minnesota Wild uniform, Chris Chelios in a San Jose Sharks uniform. So if we're talking about retro stuff, I just think that the right marketing people could take this original six idea and make this the cornerstone of the NHL. And frankly, that's what they are. They were the NHL.
Mm-hmm.
But as great as I think that will be, that would be, I know it's just not going to happen. It's too visionary. It's too good of an idea, frankly, for the NHL to even consider. I know it sounds very pompous of me to say that, but I've always wanted that to happen. And while we were in the business, my feeling was, if we're in the business of realigning anyway, why not try this? Nothing else has worked. That was my biggest thing. What has worked so well that causes you to turn your back on this idea to say, well, that would never work? It's not like you've had all this great success the other way. Let's try this. Mm-hmm. Let's just give this a decade. Give it a decade and see what happens. But it's not going to happen.
Yeah, unfortunately, and you're right. But, you know, if I was going to do it, you know, let's have the original six of the division and let's have the next six. You know, five of them exist anymore, but, you know.
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, because of the we're old school. If you ask us, the NHL's been going on a downhill slide ever since they expanded in 1967. So there you go.
There you go.
And when they added those other six teams, it was all went to hell in a handbasket. Okay. Speaking of hell in a handbasket, Greg, how about that for a segue? We got to talk a little bit.
There you go.
And I got to ask you, they've the stalemate, the labor stalemate is literally a stalemate. There's nothing going on right now. There were some meetings over the past week, but nothing earth-shaking has come from them. Looks like the ownership's on the verge of canceling more games. They've already canceled the first 2 weeks of the season. Do you find yourself missing the NBA at all? Because I'm going to give you a one-word answer. No.
And I would echo your one-word answer, and I would say no as well. No, it's easy for us because the Pistons have been so bad the last couple of years. But even if the Pistons were competitive back in the days of going to the finals and everything, I don't think I'd really miss it that much now. Anyway, I don't miss these 82-game seasons now. Yeah. I really don't. I mean, you come back at me maybe around Christmas or New Year's, and I might be a little itching for a little NBA. But right now, you know, of course, we're here where we have so many other things to take our attention away. You know, ask somebody who's a fan in San Antonio, or ask a fan who's a fan in Utah the same question. They may say, "Well, you know, no, I do miss my NBA." Well, that's understandable. There's not much else going on in those cities in terms of pro sports. But here, no, I absolutely not. The only thing I do wish could happen is I wish that Lawrence Frank could start to work with his new players. That's what's frustrating for me, and I'm sure it's frustrating for Lawrence Frank, is not being able to even see these guys' names, let alone talk to them. So that's what's frustrating, because I'd like to see how he, you know, I'd like to see him get with his players as soon as possible. It's too bad they can't have a lockout and still work together in terms of that kind of a thing. But, you know, I understand why there's a hard line on that. But that's really the only thing that bothers me about this is the coaches not being able to work with their players and with their draft choices and things of that nature. And the uncertainty that some of these guys have, who are not millionaires, by the way. I mean, they are in a way, but they're not, you know, the elite guys who make tens of millions of dollars. And they don't know what they're going to do. They don't know if they should go overseas. They don't know if they should stay. Jonas Jerebko decided to stay. Saw a piece on him about a week ago, a really good, interesting profile on him in the paper about a week or so ago. And, you know, he decided to stay. You know, I want to be here. But there are other players that have not stayed and are still considering not staying.
Oh, hell, there's a lot of NBA players playing overseas at the moment. You know, they need money.
But we all know that when the NBA comes back into play, that they can get out of those contracts like out of a wet paper bag.
Sure.
You know, that's not going to be an issue. But no, as far as do I miss the NBA? No, of course not. Not right now. No way.
Yeah, I think you put it best in that the season's too long. And if anything, say they do come back around Christmas time, that would be perfect. You know, the NFL will just be finishing up the regular season, going into the playoffs, and it makes for a much tidy, you know, 50-ish game season. Which, you know, obviously in the big scheme of things, they would never go to a 50-game season. But, yeah, there's nothing wrong with knocking 10, 15 games off the schedule at this point. It's silly, but, you know, it's all about the money. But I guess this all kind of leads to, Greg, is it really looks like the owners have drawn a line in the sand that they are not willing to cross. I mean, this is the NBA owners, and they are so desperate to protect themselves from themselves, are willing to do what the NHL did and call off the season entirely. Because I'm really getting that vibe at the moment that it very may likely come down to a point where the NBA say, screw it. You know, a lot of these owners probably make more money anyway, running out arenas or whatever.
Well, you know, I guess the feeling there is that any fan loss that they incur, and they, mm-hmm. and you're going to obviously when you do this, but you're gonna, but who are you gonna lose? You're gonna lose your fringe people. Now, when baseball went out in '95 and missed the World Series and everything, mm-hmm. or '94.
Yeah.
And missed the World Series, or canceled the World Series. And there are a lot of people that to this day will tell you, now I'm not sure how truthful they're being, but they'll tell you, oh, I stopped paying attention to baseball. They lost me in 94.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ever since they canceled the World Series, I don't pay attention. Well, I don't, first of all, I'm not, it's hard to quantify that. I don't really buy that. I think that initially they probably did lose some people because you get a little ticked off. I find it hard to believe that some 17 years later there are still hardcore people. I know Bob Page is one of them. He says mm-hmm. he is anyway.
Yeah.
who say, well, you know, I the game lost me and I don't care anymore. Okay, fine. You know, I have a feeling though that for every one of those people, there's a whole lot of other people that have forgiven and forgotten. I've forgiven and forgotten. I was right back in the I was right back in baseball the next year. I don't get caught up. I guess I'm one of these guys, Al, that doesn't take this kind of stuff personally. To me, I know, I understand that this happens sometimes in labor relations. I don't ever take it as an affront. I mean, it's frustrating, sure. I mean, I didn't like it when the NHL was out for a whole year. Not at all.
Yeah.
But I didn't personally blackball the NHL when they came back.
No.
I was glad to see them back. I mean, I think people, if they're honest with themselves, will say that they're glad when these sports come back. I think it's kind of disingenuous to say, well, you know, they've lost me. I'm never coming back. Well, I understand the frustration. And
let me just throw this in real quick. I think people who say that really weren't fans to begin with.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's what I said at the top of my answer was that, is that who are you going to lose? You're going to lose maybe the fringe people.
Yeah.
You know, I think the owners, and this is where the owners probably have the players over the barrel a little bit, mm-hmm. where they can say to themselves and to the fellow owners, look, I think we literally don't want this to happen because we are going to lose
somebody.
We're going to lose concessions and everything.
And
but you know
money.
What? But just think about the people who are not paying too, by the way. That's the other thing.
Exactly.
But the thing is that, you know, I think that they probably look at themselves and say, can we bounce back from this? Can we take one step back financially and take two steps forward if we do indeed cancel the season? And I think the NBA owners would say, yeah, I think we can do that. And that's what's probably leads you to believe that it could potentially be another NHL situation. And guess what? I hate to say it, but I think there's a baseball contract coming up pretty soon too.
Yep.
Which I don't even want to think about that, but
yeah.
You know, that there you go. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Yeah. Say what you will, at least about the NFL, they got it figured out and we have a season and people are absolutely fired up. Again, the NFL, say what you will about how they do things in the big scheme of things. They, at the very least, they're playing, and that's all that anybody wants to see.
Right.
All right, Greg, we're getting a little low on time as we, as usual, pontificated and and ran at the mouth, as we both tend to do at times. And we got about a little less than 5 minutes left in the show, which means it's time for our jerk of the week, where we call somebody out who has perturbed us in one way or another. So, Greg, who is your jerk of the week?
I'll make it very quick. My jerk of the week is Brian Billick, the Fox analyst who did the Lions game yesterday. And the reason why Brian Billick, and I usually, for the most part, I like Brian Billick, but what mm-hmm. irritated me about him yesterday was he kept blaming the Lions fans for the team's performance on the field.
Yeah.
He kept, several times he mentioned that the Lions fans have got to do more, got to get louder, First of all, I think it's incumbent upon the team to give the fans something to cheer about, number one. And number two, the Lions fans did induce, I think, two or three false start penalties from the Falcons. But he just kept on with this all game long about the fans not doing their part. He was almost kind of scolding them. And I was getting a little bit irritated with that. The Lions, frankly, didn't deserve a lot of support for the way they played yesterday. So my jerk of the week is Brian Billick.
Well, I got to say this one. You stole my jerk because I was going to use Billick as well. Because for the same reason, I could not figure out why he was blaming the fans. But But let me also. But I had a backup, and I'm just going to say I'm going to give it Tim McCarver of the Fox coming in for in the World Series for a couple reasons. One, just because, and
right, of
Tim McCarver, and two, because he has reached John Madden status, where I think he's just going through the motions. And the passion isn't there for him anymore because he's been in the game for so damn long. And as we saw this when we were both raving about Terry Francona when he was working the playoffs, and it was such the broadcast was just that much more entertaining. So my jerk of the week is both Brian Billick, thank you, Greg, and also Tim McCarver because I think Tim McCarver needs to retire. And there you go. All right, we've reached the end of another podcast. Greg, do what you do so well, and please get out the thank yous and plugs.
Okay, I am Greg Eno from GregEno.com, and that's where you can read me every day of the week. You can follow me on Twitter at Twitter.com/GregEno. Follow the Knee Jerks on Twitter, TheKneeJerks.info. Follow us on our Facebook fan page, Facebook.com/TheKneeJerks. Also write us, if you would, at TheKneeJerks@gmail.com. I want to thank Mike Schotte, of course, our Lions insider, for another terrific segment. We always appreciate that. Next week, Adam Biggers will be substituting for me. Al will be here. I will not. So Adam Biggers will be substituting. His guest, Al's guest will be Lee Panis of DetroitTigerTales.com and also another Tigers blogger who we will determine. 2 weeks from tonight, we hope to have Jamie Samuelson of WCSX here. We hope to have him there here on November 7th when I return. I want to thank my lovely wife, Sharon, and, of course, I want to thank you, Big Al, for making Monday Night So Gosh Darn Fun.
Indeed, and I want to thank you, Greg, for making Monday Night So Gosh Darn Fun, along with you can read me at WayneFonts.com and BlessYouBoys.com. Look for the next Bless You Boys podcast to be coming out probably later this week. That podcast will probably go to about a once-a-month format over the as the off-season progresses. You can also find me on Twitter. BigAl.us is the shortcut. Find me on Facebook, albeaton.com. Greg, and I just want to warn you now, I'm not sure what you're going to come back to after your week hiatus. Me and Biggers might just trash the place, so I'm just warning you right now, okay? You know, if you see a few things out of order, I'll do my best to, I'll clean up.
All I want you to do is just put things back where you found them. That's all I
have. I promise. All right, everybody. Thanks again. We'll see Greg in 2 weeks. Next week, again, as he said, it'll be myself along with Adam Biggers doing the podcast. But until that time, next Monday night at 7 p.m., this is Al Beaton saying aloha.
Ciao, Italy, everybody. We'll see you next week. Take care.